Salvo and me on the panel, and I was just saying to Mr. Massoni that each side, as you know, has 15 minutes. And Mr. Massoni, would you like to reserve what portion of that? You said you wanted to reserve. What portion have you tried to reserve?
Yes, sir, and I'll reserve 5 minutes of that time.
Okay. All right. You have that 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you may begin when you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor, may it please the court. My name is Eric Massoni for the Chesapeake Public Defender's Office. I represent Antoine Riddick in this case. Mr. Riddick was convicted of habitual offender's second offense, and the sole argument on appeal is that the judge abused his discretion in the sentence the judge trial court gave. In the habitual offender's second offense, Mr. Riddick was convicted. The habitual offender was based on prior suspensions. There was nothing in his record to indicate any other reasons such as DUI. And I'd argued at trial that essentially the only reason he was unable to get his license back is because he owed about $45,000 in court costs. And that even though he was employed due to other financial obligations such as family support, he was unable to pay that back. And I argued trial court that the court should take that into account in deciding the sentence he gave. And the trial court ultimately gave him a 2-year sentence, 1 year mandatory plus an additional year.
Mr. Massoni,
yes.
This is Judge Chapin, and excuse me for interrupting you, but you argued that the trial court should have considered that. Can you point me to any place in the transcript that indicates that the judge didn't consider it? Because the judge, of course, we both agree that the sentence range is 1 year to 5 years, and he was sentenced to an active period of 2 years, which certainly would lead one to believe that he was being lenient.
I don't believe there's, I don't think the court really had any indication one way or the other what his thought process was. Certainly, I agree, there's nothing that says the court refused to consider that in the transcript at all. Yeah, the court just says that he imposed a sentence of 2 years, and that's the extent of his reasoning in the case.
And you don't think that that was lenient given his record?
I don't, given the circumstances of the case itself. I realize that even in this case it was within the guidelines, around the midpoint of the guidelines, but just under the nature and circumstances of the actual charge in this case, I don't believe it was lenient, just because the reason being that it was financially based, that he was had his license declared habitual and that it was suspended, and that his actual priors for this actual offense were, I think it was just the one misdemeanor prior, if I recall correctly.
Well, but he continued to operate a motor vehicle, didn't he?
That's correct.
And he did have 5 prior felonies, I believe. Am I correct?
I think that's right. That's correct. And certainly the judge is entitled to take that into account. However, just given the actual nature of this charge, given the relative light impact on society it caused, it was just the fact that he was unable to pay fines and court costs that prevented him from being able to lawfully drive. That's the reason he was still a habitual offender, and that's why he was found guilty of this charge as driving, with still having the habitual offender, and he was unable to pay.
Tony, this is Judge Beals. Do we really even have authority, since it's within the statutory, framework, the statutory maximum and minimum, to even review this, given Code Section 19.2-298.01, Subpart F?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, which code section again?
I'm referring to the Section 19.2-298.01F. It's mentioned in the Commonwealth brief.
Right.
And it's the part that talks about the failure to follow any provisions of this section, or failure to follow any or all the provisions in the prescribed manner shall not be reviewable on appeal if it's within the statutory amount that's allowed.
Right. I would argue that's
General Assembly.
Yes, I think that statute applies to a slightly different argument. If I had argued that this case should be reversed because of a procedural error in how the judge filled out the guidelines or something like that, I would agree this court would have no additional authority beyond that. This is just arguing that the trial court abused his discretion in sentencing, which I recognize is obviously an uphill battle given case law on the issue about how a judge can abuse his discretion. But I don't think there's any statutory provision, and obviously the cases still say that sentences within the discretion of the court, not that the court has absolute discretion within the sentencing guidelines.
Well, if the court is outside of the sentencing guidelines, it has to give a written explanation.
That's correct.
But, of course, he wasn't outside of the sentencing guidelines.
Exactly. Right. So he doesn't have to give a written explanation or anything like that. And I agree that that makes it more difficult in my case, trying to argue, since the judge did not give any reasoning on the record as for what he considered and did not consider there's nothing on the record I can point to say that he refused to consider this argument. But as far as that statute goes, the statute itself would apply to a different scenario where he would have exceeded the guidelines and failed to explain it. So the court couldn't consider that factor, but the court can still consider whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in sentence.
Mr. McCartney, this is Judge Chaffin again. In reference to the Commonwealth, one of the Commonwealth's arguments that you waived the ability to argue by failing to object as to the sentence on the record at that time. Can you speak to that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, the way the sentencing hearing works, of course, generally speaking, is each side makes their argument. In the trial court, I argued for a more lenient sentence, and the trial court chose not to give that sentence. I think that certainly the trial court had an opportunity to rule on all the issues, was aware of all the arguments that are raised in the appellate brief. The purpose of the contemporaneous objection rule is to make sure the judge is able to rule on the issue, and I think it's just implicit in every sentencing hearing that when we're asking for a sentence other than what the judge gives, that the judge is abusing his discretion by not giving that sentence. I don't think we then have to say, Your Honor, for the record, we object to the sentence given. So I would submit to the court that we preserve that issue at least for the judge to be able to rule on the issue and for this court to then review the trial court's decision.
Thank you.
Honestly, obviously, the record, it was a guilty plea case. The record is not very lengthy. I think everything else is in my brief. If there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Any further questions for Mr. Mussoni?
No, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Mussoni, you have your rebuttal time then. Anderson?
Yes, sir. May it please the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth. Again, let me express my apology for somehow missing the start of this. I'll try to do better next time. I don't really have a whole lot to say beyond what I've said in the brief, but let me just make a few points. One, if you have a sentence such as here that falls within the statutory limit, the circumstances under which an appellate court can nevertheless overturn the sentence are few and far between. I would submit that unless you can tie it in with something else, such as the court took into account some impermissible consideration in imposing a sentence otherwise falling within the statutory limits, absent something like that, there's no basis for appellate second-guessing of the trial court's imposition of sentence, and there's been nothing here. The counsel's certainly acknowledged that there was no such impermissible consideration here that in any way caused the court or influenced the court to impose its particular sentence. So right there, I think the defendant's burden on appeal is virtually insuperable. Beyond that, I don't think that the claim is reviewable because the only explanation, or not explanation, but it's at sentencing, the defendant asked the court to basically be lenient in imposing sentence and refer to his inability to pay this fine. But the fact is that the defendant had previously entered into a plea agreement that is not presently challenged, that, as the court on several occasions made quite clear to him, was something that he would have to satisfy. Otherwise, under the express terms of the plea agreement, he would forego the benefit that otherwise he potentially had derived from it. And neither the defendant nor his counsel ever expressed the slightest problem with or objection to that. In fact, the defendant, when the court set the sentencing, which was more than 6 months after the plea hearing, the judge specifically made another cautionary remark to the defendant about the potential pitfalls of trying to pay off this fine, and the defendant, rather than saying, "Well, wait a minute, what are you talking about?" says, "I have a strong support system, sir." That's at page 31 of the appendix. Now, what do you call that? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
This is Judge Malvo. Yes. You're heading down the argument in reference to the approbate, reprobate. And the question I have for you is, how would approbate and reprobate apply to a situation where it's really not a question as to the validity of the plea agreement, but one more to the specificity of the time that was given? That was never included in the plea agreement.
But the only reason that the court was able to have the sentencing proceeding as per the plea agreement was the inability to make the payment as required under the terms of the plea agreement. So,
but the plea agreement, if it had been abided by, simply would have given him the misdemeanor conviction of driving under being a habitual offender as opposed to the felony, which is obviously sentenced differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I'm saying is that the defendant at the outset understood, and the record makes this clear, that he understood that if he did not pay this money in a timely manner and as required under the plea agreement, he would have the sentencing that he in fact had. He was perfectly prepared to accept that. So, under the Commonwealth's view of the case, that's approbate and reprobate, but in a way, this is somewhat semantical, because under any circumstances, an approbate and reprobate clearly is, there's a strong overlap between that and a procedural default, but under any circumstances, he's defaulted here. It's totally apart from what the plea agreement called for and what he understood by entering into the terms of it. When the court conducted the sentencing, the defendant simply asked the court not to go above the mandatory time. So that's what I'm asking the court to do. And counsel today has said quite candidly that if the trial court imposes any sentence beyond, apparently even a day beyond, what the defense advocates, then that by definition preserves an appellate challenge to the sentence on the ground that it's somehow an abuse of discretion. I don't know of any case that would support that proposition. I mean, if you have, for example, what robbery is what, 5 years to life, and the defendant asks for a sentence of no more than 8 years, and the court imposes 9 years, and the defendant doesn't say one word after having simply urged the court to impose a sentence of no more than 8 years, that preserves an appellate challenge. I don't think that's correct, and I don't think the case law would support that assertion. So when the defendant simply makes an argument at sentencing saying, for these reasons, please do this, and the court does something else, and the defendant at no point, whatever, then or later, objects to what the court did on the ground that it lacked the authority or it was wrong under the facts of the case, then I submit that's a default, and in Rule 5A18 bars its review. On the merits, counsel has said that there's no indication of the trial judge's thought processes. I think he said he can't point to anything in the record where the court failed to consider his arguments, and particularly in an appeal where the record is reviewed in the light most favorable to the appellee, and where if the judge doesn't offer any particular explanations for a ruling, then the appellate court looks in terms of what a reasonable judge could have relied upon in making that ruling. If you put all of that together, then the sentence is unobjectionable. Even if the court were reviewing it under some not particularly deferential standard, I submit it would easily pass muster. And in this appeal, where there's simply an unhappiness with the particular sentence meted out, I think that counts for very little and certainly is nowhere near enough to demonstrate reversible error. Otherwise, I'd rely on my brief, and if the court doesn't have any additional questions, I would close at that point.
Any questions for Mr. Anderson?
No, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Missoni, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you. I do expect to be brief. I just want to address briefly, again, the preservation error as well as the approbate and reprobate argument. For the approbate and reprobate argument, I would agree with the Commonwealth if, for some reason, we had argued that the judge should have given the misdemeanor sentence on appeal or something like that. But we didn't do that in this case. It was not a case where we agreed to something and then we argued the judge made a mistake by giving us the thing we agreed to. The case where there was a plea agreement where if Mr. Riddick did not follow through on his end or was unable to follow through on his end, I guess in his case, that he would be sentenced to the felony conviction, felony habitual offender, and that's what he did, and we're not challenging that on appeal. So I don't think it was a case of approbate and reprobate. As far as preservation go, obviously, I want to emphasize there's a difference, of course, between having preserved the issue and being able to raise it on appeal and being able to succeed on the merits. In this case, essentially, we asked for a specific thing. The judge overruled that specific thing, and that's what we're asking for on appeal. We were asking the court not to go above the mandatory time. The trial court did go above the mandatory time. That's the basis of the appeal. After that, of course, it's still reviewed for abuse of discretion, but I do think that the issue has been preserved at least for an appeal.
Mr. Missoni, yes. Can I just ask you about you're objecting on the amount of time, but you're basing it on the fact, if I understand you, correct me if I'm not, that it was really impossible for him to pay off this $45,000 in child support and in court fees and costs.
Right.
Is that right?
That's correct. But just to clarify, I don't mean that it was, I wasn't just referring to the time since the plea that it was impossible to pay off, although I don't know whether a judge would consider as mitigation his ability to get getting his license back or not, I don't know. But just in general, his ability to have gotten his license back.
Presumably, this is, he's not had a license to drive since at least 1997, is that right?
Correct. Yes.
So, presumably, based on your answer to Judge Chapin's question, and the five previous felonies as well as habitual offenses and driving offenses, as well as the failure apparently to pay child support, this is not some recent thing. This is a failure to support children and to pay court costs over a long period of time, right?
Yes, so it would almost certainly have to be. Now that being said, if he had felony convictions after 97, obviously that would add to his court costs. But yes, so it would have to be he hasn't paid in fully paid it off since 1997. That's correct.
And Judge Smith, the trial judge, talked to him about what happens if you put off paying those obligations too long, that they just build up and build up and build up, and then it becomes pretty hard, if not impossible, to pay them off.
Right. That's correct.
So I guess my question is, how is it an abuse of discretion, given this record? He had $45,000 to pay off. He's allowed this to build up over many years.
Well, and obviously, the argument was somewhat sparse as far as sentencing goes one way or the other, but it testified as far as other financial obligations, financial inability to pay. I don't think there's any reason to think, I mean, there's still the same issue of if he was unable to pay over the time, it's the same as unable to pay now. It's not necessarily that it was unwilling to pay. That would be my argument as far as that goes, that
he's been employed most of this time, is that right?
I can't recall, honestly. I don't think it's in the record specifically whether he was employed during most of this time. It may be in some of the pre-sentence report, but I believe it just focused on his current employment. So I don't believe it says whether he was employed the rest of the time or not. I don't think it says.
All right. I just wanted to delve into that a little more because I wasn't quite following
your
argument there. But thank you very much.
Thank you. I have no additional argument.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Missoni. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The case is submitted, and we will be back in touch with counsel shortly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.